podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and Phil Brining. Hello, the both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
The three of us are back after a week off.
Three Musketeers.
Yeah. At the award-winning Musketeers.
Exactly.
Just throw that in there. So this week's session was a GDPR radio. For those of you who are new to it, it's where we talk about all sorts of data protection things, whether it's relevant or not. And this week was definitely on brand, really. But it was a good session. How did you find it?
I enjoyed it, actually. I thought it was just lacking that structure enough to make it, you know, really quite good. You know, it covered a lot of ground, covered a lot of different topics, you know, dived off down tangents, it did a little bit on the news. I thought, I don't know what everybody else thought, but I thought it was a good session.
Yeah, I enjoyed the conversation on cookies at the beginning, because you two have been, you know, going on about cookies for weeks now, and I must just switch off when that happens. Let me get to grip a little bit with this and understand it a little bit more. So thank you for that insight. It's really fascinating, actually.
The whole area cookies, great, isn't it, Joe?
It is, yeah. It's
what I like about it most is that it's very straight to the point, and it's not really open to interpretation, whereas although that's a good thing with the GDPR, you get a little bit sick of kind of, you know, and asking all these questions, and, you know, as we spoke out in the session about data concerning health.
Yeah.
But they're left very broad, and it can often lead to frustrations, can't it, as well as, you know, I don't know, it's just, yeah, cookies. Governance is
it's quite prescriptive. Yeah, it's quite prescriptive, but what we've found is that, you know, despite it being, you know, relatively prescriptive, that every time we look at anybody's cookie compliance, we found they're not compliant. You know, the rules are, we think, quite clear, but, you know, we find that it's not properly governed, and we find, you know, every single thing on the checklist is like a no, and it's quite surprising. Especially as it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, 2003, right? So,
11, the cookie law, you know, the cookie modification came in 2011, I think it was.
Ah, okay, I stand corrected, but still a long time, 13 years.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I wonder why it took 13 years for the ICO to consider clamping down on something that's been around for so long.
They probably haven't understood it the same as nobody else has.
Yeah, maybe they weren't aware of the cookies placed.
What else we talk about, Jess? Talk about CCTV.
Yeah, Ring doorbells a little bit, and similar CCTV devices. And also, I enjoyed the conversation on the NHS's new AI technology that they're introducing for, is it physio?
Yes, yeah. For physiotherapy. So that you're right, that was interesting, and it will be something to keep an eye on for sure. I think it was just around the triage of an individual, as opposed to actually giving a diagnosis. And obviously the aim of that is to cut down on wait times, which is obviously an issue at the moment with the NHS. So I think the idea of it is good, but I think perhaps the execution might just be slightly off. But, you know, we'll have to keep an eye on that one as it develops.
Definitely. And also Warrow's book.
I can't remember who mentioned it on a podcast the other week, and I was compelled to go and buy a copy of it. And then Joe read it yesterday in about 25 seconds, and I spent this morning poring over it, working through reading it. And it's good. It's a good effort, isn't it, to try and bring data protection into primary schools, and it does need to be raised, doesn't it? So it was good kind of that we've got that, and we've talked a little bit about it, and I'm going to leave it back in the office so everyone can have a look at it and, you know, read it. Yeah. Such a cute bear.
It's a really good concept, and hopefully more, you know, it'll set an example for other data protection authorities, including the ICO, and more similar, I suppose, measures will follow.
Yeah.
But anyway,
we had a good kick around, as we did in the office yesterday, of the concept of data related to health. That again, that was quite good, because there's lots of unanswered questions. I sent to Roth this morning an email, you know, read these cases. This is about CCTV. Read these cases and tell me if you've got all your questions answered. And he came back, nope. Oh, no surprise there.
Yeah, but yeah, anyway, we'll let you listen to the main part of the session, and we hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back next week for an episode on the charity sector with guest speaker Rebecca Wells, so stay tuned for that one. Let's make a start officially. Part
officially.
Two.
So what have you been up to this week then? I mean, what we talked about last week was quite interesting, because what I read is that the ICO's producers thing of the five most requested FOIA topics, which was kind of continuation from last week, broken down by sector. And in health, for instance, it's meetings, committees and minutes, data and statistics, complaints, recruitment and staffing information, including fuel allowance and travel costs, policies and mental health care. So, and this kind of local government that seems to be highway parking is the top. That could be relating to potholes, who knows, bus lanes and bus services next down, children's schools and care, and education, admissions, grade scores and results, management and finances. I guess this is help people make decisions about whether which school to send their children to. Central government at the top of the table is data and statistics, correspondence, communications, meetings, still bits about COVID-19. And the emergency services is kind of a statistical information, which could well be performance data requested by journalists, hate crimes, crimes of a sexual nature, assault, vehicle and fleet, roads and speed limits. So it's quite interesting that we'd come off this podcast, and then I don't know how when this was produced, but I found that in the on the ICO's website after we'd done the after we'd done it, yeah. So that was quite interesting, and a kind of a relate back to hark back to next last week. Now next week, have we got Rebecca on? Because she's written a brilliant piece in LinkedIn, hasn't she, Rebecca Wells from Sustrans, about
Agreed.
Data protection in charities. I don't know if anybody's seen that already, but I think it's really, really quite quite good. You know, some of the stuff that makes you stop, think about stuff.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week.
So oh, we right, don't okay. know.
Just in case we
don't want to take the sting away from next week's session. Yeah,
I'm getting
yeah.
carried away with myself, Jasmine. You didn't say you hadn't done any
as always.
Galloping into it all.
I've done a little bit. I've read a few news pieces, but yeah, so I believe you was at InfoSec last week, Phil. Did you speak about that last week or?
Briefly spoke about it. I mean, I did get down to InfoSec. I spent 2 days in London, actually, because the next day was the Salesforce World Tour, which I wanted to go to. I didn't get there in the end because there was a tube problem. And I'd agreed to meet a customer who'd flown in from Jamaica. So I kind of wanted to go and spend time. And he got delayed by an hour because of the tube problem on the Circle Line. But InfoSec was really good. My key takeaways were I went round specifically to look for cookie scanning tools and supply chain management tools. So what I'm looking for is a tool that I can do the due diligence with, you know, or we can do the due diligence with as a community. So I want to put in a company and then find out information about them and you know, it tell me about their security, the information that's published, you know, whether they're data process agreements, if they're a process that are compliant, and so on and so forth, international transfers. I want all of that, and I want to automate it. Now, we're talking to some AI companies about building that tool, because I haven't found it, but I did find quite a lot of supply chain management tools. But they tend to focus on the ISO 27001 and the DORA regulations rather than privacy. So I'm just kind of now wading through exploring all the leaflets that I picked up and people I went to see to find out if it'll do what we as a privileged practitioners want it to do. And on the cookie scanning tool, I did find some quite interesting things I'm following up now. But again, most of the scanning technology is looking for vulnerabilities. And everyone said, oh yeah, come into the stand there. We can do website scanning for cookies. Oh yeah, we can do that. I want it to do this. Oh no, we can't do that. That was a bit frustrating. And another thing that was really prevalent was there's quite a lot of biometrics companies with various scanning devices. And I pulled one to one side, a Japanese company. I said, you know, the Information Commissioner's Office have produced guidance in light of Serco that this technology is not really to be used in the UK for access control. And they were completely, oh, yeah, whatever, go away. Let's try and sell some of this stuff. So I went around every single stand to ask them if they did this supply chain management and cookies. So I was absolutely worn out at the end of the day. But it was good to get down there.
Yeah. So obviously you and Joe have been doing a cookie audit for a particular customer, and you've got more involvement in that. I don't really understand what that entails. So, you know, by looking for a cookie scanning tool and vulnerabilities, what kind of vulnerabilities do you see or do you find?
But we're not looking for, we're not interested. I mean, from a cookie scanning and cookie audit perspective, we're not interested in vulnerabilities. We're interested in, can we get a web scanning tool that will scan a website and identify all the cookies, all the scripts, all the pixels, all the web beacons, all the other similar technologies that are doing the same function, that are writing data into the regulated stuff, that's writing data into a device and reading data from that device, you know, under the privacy directive. So that's what we're looking for. The vulnerability side, I kept saying, I'm not interested in that. Well, of course we are interested in that, but not for the exercise of a cookie scan. So what we want is a tool that'll do a website scan reliably, because you can look at a website and use some of the free plugins, extensions in Chrome, like Ghostery or Privacy Badger, and they come up with different results, which doesn't inspire you with confidence. Mm. And we used the OneTrust tool, didn't we, Joe? And we actually didn't. The client uses OneTrust and used the OneTrust tool, and we weren't convinced it was coming up with reliable results either. But what you wanted to say, Jasmine, is on this page, we have found all these cookies. This is the category of cookie, you know, strictly necessary performance, functional, tracking, or unknown. This is who owns the cookie. It's a persistent or a session cookie. This is how long it lasts. This is a description of what it's doing, you know, and all that tends to come from the cookie provider or from a database. But it did do bits of that, but it did do anything for pixels and JavaScripts and for tags and web beacons, you know. So when we scanned this site, there was 173 cookies found. There were thousands of cookies found, but you know, a lot of it's same cookie on a different page. So it boiled down to 103 distinct cookies. I think it was it, Joe?
On the first
scan. But we kept getting such unreliable results. We kept asking for a new scan, and it kept coming back with different stuff. In the end, we worked on a report that had something like 63 cookies, distinct cookies on it. And it broke it down, and a lot of them, it said, oh, I don't know what this one does. Can't categorize this. It's an unknown cookie. But there were providers like Microsoft, you know, and we could Google the cookie name. And on Google, it came back with, this is the provider. This is what the cookie does. So we were thinking, well, why isn't that information in the OneTrust database? You know, surely it should be, they should know about it if we can Google it and find out about it. The whole thing was a bit unsatisfactory, to be honest. And then we had 3,900 scripts, pixels, iframes, and various other things that weren't categorized at all. And then the next challenge will be, well, you say these are strictly necessary. What are they doing and why are they strictly necessary? And then, of course, what's in the privacy policy? We were comparing the privacy policy to what I actually found, when we found that they were different as well. In fact, there was two cookie policies containing different information about the various cookies. So the whole thing needed a bashing into shape. That's the purpose of the cookie audit, was to really interrogate what was going on and, you know, make recommendations to bring it in line with the PECA and the e-privacy directive. But the fundamental starting point is, have we got a really good, robust, trustworthy scanning tool to do it?
And so far
we haven't.
That's really interesting. I think so. Obviously the ICO has been doing some action really, and getting in contact with certain organizations to improve the cookie compliance. Would you expect them to go to this, you know, level of all organizations to go to this level of detail? Because I don't think it's something that really occurs.
Well, you basically got to meet the requirements, haven't you, set out in the law, which is inform people about, you know, cookies in general. That's kind of a general thing, but then inform people about the cookies that are being used. And provide meaningful information, and it kind of crosses over with then the fair processing notices, the privacy notices. You know, what information are you providing? Is it fair? Is it transparent processing? And I mean, when we mentioned consent mechanisms, because then we're testing consent mechanisms. You know, where is the consent? How is consent obtained? What is the opt out? How prominent is the reject all and the accept all? Is there a reject all button? So again, we were comparing, to try and benchmark this client against their peers in their industry. We were looking at their competitors and saying, well, look, this company have got this, that company have got that, this other company have got that. And generally speaking, they were all a little bit more compliant than our
client.
But
they were still wide of the mark, though, weren't they? So it was quite hard to say this is the standard that you should be working against because, you know, your main competitor does it, because they still weren't doing it, were they? There were still areas of their compliance that was missing.
Yeah, and we found some horrendously non-compliant practices with some big UK brands. Again, it's really surprising that, you know, that this day and age, you know, the ICO announcing they're going to clamp down, they've got a robotic way of scanning websites. So they're going to scan everyone's website because they're not doing it manually. You know, they've got this tool that'll go just churn through them all. So it's something we need to get on top of.
Mm. So what would you say the vulnerabilities are then?
Are you talking vulnerabilities on websites or cookie non-compliance? Yeah. Well, on every count, we found on every single count, you know, so there was absolutely no governance and no. So we call these things cookie policies on websites, a list of cookies, but there's no actual policy on cookies. We couldn't find any kind of our policy is to have this mechanism for approving cookies. Do you know what I mean? So there's no governance and management of cookies we found. And I suspect there isn't any of that in most places. And that means that there's no control over what goes on, what comes off, you know, who's making the decisions, how are they arriving at those decisions. And then the actual list of cookies usually doesn't relate to actually what is there. List of cookies is usually, you know, there's a disconnect there. Mm. The amount of information about cookies and what you're supposed to provide is multiple layers down, really hard to find, sometimes inconsistent. The consent mechanisms are so on every single measure in the e-privacy directive, the PECA, we're finding non-compliances. So the whole thing, in our experience, limited experience, yeah, admittedly, is a bit out to sea, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Lynn's asked in the chat, are you saying that even if we don't click on the reject all button, it might not actually be working?
That's a really good point, because I'm convinced that some sites, if you reject all, it just means, you're rejecting all cookies rather than legitimate interest cookies. I really do not trust these tools at all. Mm. That's a really, really good point.
That is something we did check, though, as well, isn't it? That when we press reject all, then when we go into the preferences, you know, has it not consented us to the placement of the cookies?
Correct. And so that's assuming you can get back into the preference center. Again, we found once you've accepted or rejected, there's no way of retracing your steps and changing it in some cases.
Yeah, which of course is a big no-no, isn't it?
Yeah, but a lot of people use tools, Jazz. You know, there's like the OneTrust tool, there's the TrustDark tool, there's the, I can't remember the others, but there's quite a few tools that are there to help with compliance. But again, they all seem to have weaknesses in them, because we found them by doing this quite thorough, you know, digging about in that area.
I was going to say, while we're on the topic of the reject all, I think something else that's quite common is that when a user presses reject all, then they leave the website and come back on. It's often they're prompted again, aren't they, with the cookie banner asking them to consent again. Mm. And obviously that's considered an infringement of the law as well, isn't it? Because consent, you can't just keep asking for it just because someone said no.
No, so what I mean, the weakness there seems to be, you know, you ought to be placing a cookie that says they've rejected all cookies. But I mean, that sounds counterintuitive, but that's the way to manage it, isn't it? You know, you got to, that one is a strictly necessary cookie, you know, in order for you to comply with the law, you know.
That's like the right to erasure. You know, you've got to keep a record of that right to erasure with that individual, even though they've requested the data be deleted.
And I think Toby's right as well. Finding what's been going on. You know, we're doing a cookie audit. You know, ideally you need a kind of a fresh browser with no cookies on it so you can see what's being placed, or a private window or something. And you go on a site and you find there's cookies placed before you've even gone through the process of looking at the cookie information and so on and so forth. So I think there's a lot of bad practice in there. But I think it's just because it's not governed. You know, what we found is there's no management of it at all.
Yeah, I think it's funny because when I've advised on, you know, cookies in the eyes of the law in the past, so making sure you've got a proper cookie policy and consent mechanism in place, part of having that cookie policy is being transparent and listing, you know, what cookies you've got, what they do. So I'd advise the customer to go back to their web developers and ask them for this information. And usually when they come back, there's probably no more than 20 cookies in that list, and you're saying that it's pulled back like 100 odd, or you know, you finalized on 63. Even that, it just doesn't seem legit.
Well, nobody seems to know what's going on. So we were saying, get back in touch with your web development team and find out. Well, it seems that nobody really has got kind of opinion is nobody really seems to have a grip of it. You know, the web developers, we don't know how they place cookies. Some cookies are actually, I think, masked by being placed by a tag manager. So there might be a reference to a tag manager in the web page. That takes you off to Google Tag Manager or Adobe Tag Manager or something, and the tag manager might be placing, you know, tags, pixels, etc., outside of the code on the page. So the web developers might not be aware of it because the marketing team might have started using a tag manager, and by using a tag manager, just popped this tiny little piece of code into the page. So that's what I mean by having a cookie policy. You know, who is going to do what? What technologies are you going to be using? How are you going to make sure that they're approved? We're not saying don't do it. We're saying get it under control.
Mm.
We were saying the same. Get back in touch with the web developers and find out what's going on. Get back in touch with your marketing department, but nobody had control over it.
And that's worrying, though, isn't it, when organisations, there's cookies on the websites and even them themselves don't know what they're doing and why they're there. And that's the question that we then ask, you know, if you don't know what they're doing, why are you placing it on your website? If you don't know, get rid of it.
Yeah, we were saying that was one of your big pieces of advice, Joe, is if nobody owns up to it being their cookie, take it off. You know, and then see who complains.
Yeah. If marketing then like, oh, we don't know who's been visiting our website. There you go. That's what the cookie was doing. It was identifying the amount of traffic that was visiting your website. So, yeah. But what do we?
So anyway, that was cookies. Cookies. Now I came up with have you got any more?
No, that's it for cookies.
Now I was talking to Rofi yesterday. I was in the office yesterday and I talked to him about a couple of really interesting things. One was, data related to health. So one of our clients is collecting a medical form to check their employees' ability to drive company vehicles. So I said to him, well, why would you need to do that? I'm throwing it out there, expecting the chat to light up now. Why would you need to do that? Because everyone's got a responsibility to inform the DVLA if they've got any impediments. So there you could just get people to write a declaration saying, I've got no medical impediments to stop me from driving, in theory. But then when we checked on the definition of data related to health, you know, that in itself would probably be data related to health and therefore caught by Article 9 of the GDPR. So that was quite interesting, the absence of information. You know, the very statement, yeah, I am a fit and healthy person, you know, is data related to health and therefore requires an Article 9. Again, that seems a little bit bonkers because we were struggling then to find a really good applicable Article 9 or Schedule 1 condition for that purpose.
Did you settle on one?
I can't remember.
Helpful.
I think we came to the conclusion that, you know, you could rely on explicit consent because you could be telling people, you know, we need this information to allow you to drive the vehicle. If you don't give it, we won't allow you to drive the vehicle. If they subsequently withdraw consent, it don't really matter, actually, because you already know that they're fit to drive unless their medical circumstances change. So this is about the processing of the data, isn't it, that they're consenting to. So it was quite interesting, sort of academic brain stretching discussion. We looked through employment, we looked through health and safety law, we looked through all sorts of different possibilities. We thought, well, maybe consent would work in this case.
It's interesting because where do you draw the line? You know, like you say, if you say, you know, you don't even have to say I'm fit and healthy, all you can say is, you know, it's approved by the DVLA. You can draw conclusions from that. You know, you are fit and you've got no medical conditions that would stop you from driving. So where is that line that it is no longer health data or health related?
So what you're saying, because all of us, if we're able to drive, that means we're fit and healthy. That means it's our, so my driving license.
Oh, not necessarily.
Is my health data.
No, not necessarily.
Is that what you're saying, Jasmine? Not, or where's the line to stop?
You're not necessarily fit and healthy. It just, you haven't got any health conditions that would affect your ability to drive.
Lawrence had his hand up.
Yeah, Lawrence usually helps clarify things.
I was going to ask or try and point out, or I don't know if I clarify anything. God, that's very generous of you on a Friday afternoon. It was more of, it shouldn't there be a positive affirmation of some form? Because otherwise, even just existing is healthy. You know, if you're just going through, there has to be something where, I think there has to be a break point or a step change to say, this has become health data, like what Jasmine was saying, where there has to be something that transitions it into health data. I know what you're saying, where the absence of it can also indicate health data, but there has to be a point of thing, as Joe was saying, with, well, if we're all driving on the roads and we're able to drive on the roads, the assumption there is you're, you know, we're all sober, let's say, that we're not drunk. But if you gave somebody a breath analyzer, you're taking a positive action to determine their health status. And that breath analyzer, for example, would be health data as well as criminal offense data.
I suppose it could be the purpose behind the processing, but whatever that is. So I suppose in this instance, they need to know that that person is fit and healthy. So there's some intention behind it in relation to that individual's health rather than it being unrelated. I don't know.
It was really just, we were really quite picky about the definition of data concerning health, you know, means personal data related to physical and mental health, blah, 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 which reveal information about his or her health status. And it's that status that made us think. I mean, I have to say, you know, we do this, we have these conversations sometimes, not as practitioners, but as academics, you know, like, oh, let's get on our ivory tower and high horse and start picking the GDPR wording apart. But it's just the wording of it makes you think, well, it's actually really, really quite broad. And in practical terms, you know, is it the intention to try and capture this type of information that we're talking about now, you know, by Article 9? I'm not having to go here, Lawrence, at all. I love the analogy that just because people on the road, you assume they're sober. It's like just because you're processing personal data, we assume you're compliant. It's exactly the same kind of parallel.
Anyway, when you think of data concerning health, you always think of in a negative way, don't you, in terms of like, you know, a medical condition as opposed to them being healthy. So I think that's probably something that I'd probably not quite pondered. And it's obviously intentionally left quite a broad definition, isn't it? So that a lot's captured. But is it too broad that everything's caught, as we've mentioned there, about being healthy is still your health status, isn't it? And obviously everything's kind of captured, isn't it? So us sat here right now, we're healthy. Is that our data concerning health?
Well, if it's personal data revealing your health status, you know, so me sat the definition.
Here, me sat here right now, I said at the start, I've got a bit of a snotty nose. Is that me
thank you, Jim,
telling everyone on the podcast process?
We've been through that, podcast, don't worry, Phil.
This podcast is processing my special category data. Just because I've said I'm a little bit unwell.
You've made it public then, haven't you?
So, oh yeah, I'm not saying that there's no like lawful basis, because that was my choice to disclose that.
But that doesn't mean to say, just because he's made it public doesn't say we can take that and use it, does it? He hasn't given us permission to use it for any purposes.
Yeah, but we're not using it, are we? If he's no. You know, he's read the privacy.
I'm going to avoid
notice.
Him, so I'm going to use it.
We're just going down a rabbit hole here, aren't we?
Anyway, it was quite an interesting discussion. Interesting. I think, you know, we were thinking like, you know, if you had an employee that was, you know, on medication for a temporary condition, you know, maybe some treatment program, and they were then not able to drive for a period of time, you know, drug cancer treatment or something, or, you know, more permanently suffering from epilepsy, or, you know, they had some kind of anxiety and depression that really affected them, panic attacks that made them unable to drive. You know, this is kind of stuff that really you probably need to know as an employer to make sure that it's safe for your employee and safe for other road users.
Yeah, so could you not say that under Article 9, that's under employment law, you know?
Yeah, we said that was a possibility as well, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Rolfe was keen to say it was protecting people at risk, yeah, of the lunatic behind the wheel.
The drunk lunatic.
Exactly, yeah.
So would substantial public interest probably be, or possibly be at play there then, if it's protecting individuals at risk?
That was tongue-in-cheek, Jansen. That was tongue-in-cheek.
I mean, it went that way, but I remember it for your first comment.
we kicked it around for a bit in the office, which was quite good fun. Another thing we kicked around the office was CCTV. So when I'm sure you've got lots of things you want to talk about, so I'm going to shut up for a little while.
No, it's fine. We can.
You
go
can't
down the
drop that and then just
CCTV.
Move on.
Well, all right. This was again, Rofi had an inquiry from a social housing provider saying that they had wanted some advice about their tenants using ring doorbells and other kind of CCTV type of things. And you know, they wanted to know what they should do about it. I said to Rofi, well, yeah, have a look through some of the cases, you know, because what's funny about the cases, I think that a lot of the judgments are wrong. So we had a look. I told him to go and have a look at the Rain. You remember the Rainers case 2014 in Czech Republic, was it? Where the guy house was being vandalized. He put up CCTV and he got prosecuted for GDPR contraventions. So in fact, it was pre-GDPR, so Data Protection Directive contraventions. And he that was deemed that he was. And the whole thing seemed to be, if you, you know, the guidance seems to be that if you were, not now, but then, if you were processing and your cameras caught public areas, then it was a physical, I think we talked about this before on here, the physical boundaries seemed to be the thing that the courts were saying, that's what is determining whether you're a controller or not, you know, whether domestic processing applies or not. Whereas in fact, you know, my assertion is it's processing oriented, it's purpose orientated. So if you're filming in the public, but you're only using that data for your own personal purposes, then surely the household exemption kicks in. Rofi then mentioned about, do you remember Fairhurst and Woodard? The guy,
you have to explain it.
Audio technician who put tons of cameras on his property and doctor next door complained about it. And he also was found to have have transgressed the GDPR. And that was in 2021. But I said to Rofi, this was a county court. So in my opinion, with respect to the courts, you know, a low level court, not like the High Court, the Supreme Court, or the Court of Appeal. So, you know, but he never used that as a defence. He didn't use as a defence the fact that it was household processing. He did share the data with neighbours and the police. So in my book, he was a controller as soon as he did that. But it was just interesting to read those things. And anyway, Rofi worked through all this stuff to help his client think about CCTV. But it just brought it back into our focus about the ICO's guidance, current guidance on CCTV. And they say it's really hard to regulate. You know, yeah. They say on their guidance, yeah, you know, that it's not illegal to put up ring doorbells and other things that cover public spaces. But they admit that if anybody complains to them, they can't do much about it.
Yeah, I had the exact same question this week. I got a bit surprised when you brought that up.
All right.
Yeah, so I sent over a few pieces of information to him about, you know, CCTV overlooking neighbours' houses and you know, gardens and so on. And what the law, what, you know, how to manage that. And I suppose the best thing is to not take responsibility as an organization for it, because, you know, similar to what the ICO was saying, it, like, it's the hardest thing to manage and oversee.
Yeah, I said, Trophy, imagine you've got a tenement building or something, and you got like 20 flats in it, and everyone's got a ring doorbell. You know, you're going to potentially get all sorts of little disputes between neighbors, and you do not want to be in the middle of that. I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, Christopher said you can create privacy areas which blur footage using ring doorbells, but I think some people put ring doorbells in, you know, for the exact opposite of that, really, to spy on the neighbours or to catch them out or whatever it is. It's funny, we work with a lot of housing clients, and some of the stories that you hear of neighbours arguing with neighbours, I just think, how do you get to that point? It's ridiculous. So there's all sorts that goes on. I just hope I'm never in that situation myself, because it sounds like a headache.
I think private prosecutions, you know, private prosecutions is a way to go on it. Now, the ICO say that their advice only applies to fixed cameras, so it doesn't apply to roving cameras such as drones or dash cams. So again, that's interesting to consider. And they say that you know, they refer in that for domestic and household purposes as well. So it's just a tricky area, isn't it? But that's what we like about working in this space, tricky areas.
Definitely.
Anyway, I seem to have rabbited on for half an hour. So what have you two noticed in the news or been up to?
I've seen a very interesting news story, actually. I came across it on LinkedIn, and it's about the NHS is set to offer patients AI physio. So apparently the first NHS AI run physiotherapy clinic is set to be rolled out this year in an effort to cut waiting times amid growing demand and staff shortages. The new platform will provide same-day automated video appointments with a digital physiotherapist via an app that responds to information provided by a patient in real time. It's the first platform of its kind to be approved by the health regulator, the Care Quality Commission, as a registered healthcare provider. Patients seeking physiotherapy for issues such as back pain can be referred to the platform through a community or primary care healthcare setting such as their GP. They can also self-refer directly into the service. The service aims to provide faster care and reduce waiting times and pressure on clinicians, those behind it say. Waiting lists for treatment for musculoskeletal problems such as back, neck and knee pain have grown by 27% since January last year. According to the NHS website, more than 30 million working days are lost to musculoskeletal conditions every year in the UK, and they account for up to 30% of GP consultations in England. So I thought that was really seriously quite interesting, because I think although it's been approved, you know, have they considered the kind of the wider risks of, you know, the data protection side of things? And, you know, you're putting in there your own information, but what, you know, what if you're inaccurate, and then that leads to the AI providing you with advice that could cause, you know, further injury to yourself? You know, who would be liable for that? Would it be the NHS, or would it be the company behind the AI model?
How does it work? Is it just a text thing? Is it like an avatar that's giving you all the?
I'm not sure. Moves there. I'm not sure. I think you just go on and you speak to it and just say what's up with you, like you would at a doctor's, I guess. Right. But the thing is, when you go to a doctor's and you go to physio, they often kind of pick your arms up, don't they, and move it around, you know, kind of see how it acts and if it hurts when it's in a specific, you know, specific position. Yeah. And obviously AI won't be able to do that, will it? So surely all it's going to do is say, it's just going to lead to, not really going to cut out that issue, and it's just going to lead to kind of more, oh, you know, we're unsure, we're going to have to refer you to an actual person who can lift your arm up and see if it hurts in this particular position. I don't know, but it just alarm bells rang for me straight away.
Yeah, Michael wants to come in. Did you do physio when you were doing sports science? Are you a qualified physiotherapist or something?
No, sports science is very generous as well, Phil. It was just sports coaching I did.
Oh, right, okay. All right, fine. Michael's got his hand up, moving on.
I think, you've got to consider that they might be, you know, they're looking at the AI Act publishing next year, aren't they? If we as patients provide the wrong information to the doctors or anyone, any clinicians, and they don't have any tests to back it up, they just listen to what we say and we give the wrong information, and then they make the wrong advice to them, then it'd be, quite interesting to see how those cases go, right? Because you could argue that, like for example, I give them the blood of someone else if they're doing a test. They should check, right? But then they start giving me all these different treatments, cut off my arms and legs, and then I say to them, oh, well, you shouldn't have done that because I gave you the wrong blood at the beginning. It's like, but you're right. Like the logic of the data and the accuracy of it depends on the whole point of the AI, right? So essentially, if the data is wrong, or we've been using not everything we have, or the patient hasn't given us information from some tests or diagnosis from somewhere else, they could be acting on the wrong information or old information to that effect. So there's probably going to be some sort of limitation there.
Yeah, we don't know how strenuous the exercises are or whatever. It could be, you know, very superficial, because I guess there is a possibility of doing an exercise and actually exacerbating the damage or creating more damage. But it'd be interesting.
Or something, right?
Yeah, it could be interesting how that maps out.
I've just read a little bit on the article, actually. I was opening it back up to have a little look, and it says that Flock, which I presume is the application behind it, is also the first technology to be granted medical device clearance under MHRA regulations for fully automating this triage assessment and treatment of back pain. The system provides autonomous assessments and triage as opposed to diagnosis. Flock uses an automated process to determine whether a patient can instantly have access to physiotherapy appointments or is triaged to another service such as NHS 111 or their GP. Flock has not received any reports of missed red flags from the trials, they said. Stevenson said that the autonomous triage process is subjected to rigorous continuous testing. So I get in, you know, that doesn't seem too bad, does it? It's kind of maybe the first kind of layer of the process of understanding what kind of medical implications you might have. So it's kind of saying, okay, yeah, it's that severe that we can refer you to a physiotherapy, or we're not quite sure, it's going to need further testing, and therefore we're going to refer you on to your GP. So, you know, I think the concept behind it of pulling down waiting times on the NHS is good, because, you know, it's clearly an issue. There's tons of people, isn't there, waiting for things on the NHS, and it's things need to change for us to kind of get to grips with it. So I think the idea behind it is good. It's just, you know, whether the execution follows that, I guess.
I think, you know, it's not a good thing in our profession to assume anything, but, you know, you assume that they do consider these the potential risks with this and do the best to mitigate them. I just hope that, you know, I hope that they're getting this information not just from scraping Google, because Google can convince you that, you know, a headache turns into a brain tumor within half an hour of scrolling through a few articles. So either that or talking to you, Joe, with my headaches.
I'm just trying to look out for you. Sorry.
Now, we mentioned last week briefly about the ICO giving advice about the general election. Again, I don't know if you've seen that. They have a page about this. But it's all fairly obvious stuff, I think, you know, about that you should be provided with a privacy notice. And it's all pretty obvious. But actually, Rishi's team came around and knocked on my door earlier, because Rishi is my MP. So I've got Rishi and his team came around to see you. It wasn't Rishi himself, but his team came around. I called today, Matthew opened the door, and I had a good old chat with them and sent them on their way. So ICO's produced this stuff about the general election. Have you seen that?
You probably haven't
seen it.
No. I think I have seen it. I think I've definitely read a blog that they posted saying, kind of setting out guidance for political parties, and then what you can expect from the ICO as well.
Yeah, you should expect clear privacy information. You should be expected to be told about political parties in profiling. You should expect the information about social media advertising. You should expect to be told information will be used in a survey or from a survey. Expect political parties to follow the law when it comes to direct marketing. Sets it out. And it's quite good. But, you know, to a practitioner, I guess we'd be saying, oh yeah, we know all this. But for, you know, if anybody ever reads it who's not a privacy practitioner, it's probably quite useful. And then on election day, I've got a show ID, you know, and what the ICO is going to do. It's quite an interesting read, I suppose. But just interesting that they've taken that step to produce that, you know, during the Rob's election. Just putting a link to it.
Thanks, Phil.
A link to it there.
Have you got the book to hand?
Waro.
It's in the office, I think, isn't it? Or did you take it back with you, Phil?
I got it this morning.
What were your thoughts?
I thought it rambled on for a lot, and it used some quite grown-up
language. Just
for a bit
of context for those that weren't on the session where we spoke about this. So Guernsey's Data Protection Authority has produced a data protection related book for children. So Phil obviously had to order that straight away, and it's arrived and he's had a read through it. So just as a bit of context for those that didn't hear it last time.
Yeah, if everyone was to have a look at it, you know, I'm going to send it to the office, but you're more than welcome to. It was $4.99, and the money goes into a charity, children's charity, I think. But it's 32 pages long. I wasn't sure at the end of it, Joe. I thought it's like a lot of rambling, and then suddenly Waro the bear is in this data lake, and then it jumps to, you know, all you need to know is who is asking, what do they want, why do they want it, and where will it go. These are the four key things it's suggesting that children need to be aware of. It's aimed at primary school children, and it does come with teachers' notes and parents' notes as well, but I wasn't entirely sure the messaging in it, were you?
No, it took about half of the book to actually get into the nitty gritty around data protection. It like you said, it kind of jumped, didn't it, from just a bear kind of waking up, and then all of a sudden he's finding lost school reports on, you know, the side of a lake, and then he was inside the lake. And yeah, I think the idea behind it, the concept's really good, but the execution's quite poor, and there's words in there that I don't think a 5, 6, 7-year-old probably understand. I mean, kids maybe these days are a lot more intelligent than when I was at school, but I can't remember some of the words in there, but I was thinking, would I have known this at 7 or 8 years of old?
Well,
years
they of age? Don't make, yeah, but it all rhymes as well. So,
yeah, it does, true.
In a way, they have to try and find, so in front of a now rolling hills made of ledges, all covered with lines of handwritten treasures, you know, ledges. anyway, it rhymes. That's it.
I much prefer your story. Is it Bill?
Is
it Bill?
No, interesting. Cara's bought this, and she said a 7-year-old wasn't interested. Right, okay, interesting. Presumably, you got the parents' guidance notes with it as well. Interesting.
You have to give it to Alex's kids, see if she see if their kids take an interest in it.
One and three.
They won't know. I will leave it in the office when I'm next in, which might be Monday, and then everyone can do what they want with it. But apparently, Waro means high in Guernsey's local language, and it also fits in with the four things that the book tells kids to do. They need to know who, why, what, where on Waro. So anyway, yes, I did buy it, Joe, and I did read it, and I thought it was a really good idea, as you say, but not entirely sure. For me, it quite hit the mark, but
you'll have to write one yourself, Phil.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Along with the cookie scanning tool.
Yes, yeah. Now, did make you millions. See, I saw in the news that there's been, you know, we were working on a certification scheme, but it ran into the quicksand. But the ICO has now got a certification scheme for legal practitioners. And there's two law firms who have been assessed and have now got this certificate called LOCS 23 standard. Again, I don't know much about it, just saw a news story about it, but I was quite interested that there is now a official certification scheme out there for that kind of industry. I don't suppose you've seen that, have you?
I saw it when it first, when it was first released, the LOCS, is it LOCS 24 or LOCS 23?
LOCS 23, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I've not seen much since. I think it's a good thing, though, especially because, you know, in the legal industry, there's a lot of confusion or presumptions around the relationship, you know, with clients and what. So typically, you know, the controller relationships with other organizations, whereas it, you know, they can be misconceived to be, is that, I don't know if that's the right word, to be controller to processor. So just having something, you know, that provides some sort of certainty and you know, a target to hit in terms of compliance is a positive thing, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know the scope of it, because what we were trying to work at was a really quite broad scope thing. This could be quite narrow in its scope, I don't know, but I noticed that there's now a couple of people who got that certification. Another thing, I don't know if you're going into the news, I saw a few things actually. One was somebody highlighted in a blog the fact that in a really harrowing sexual abuse case, the teachers and social workers were basically saying, well, we destroyed all of our notes and destroyed all the paperwork because we were told it infringed the GDPR, and the judge was saying, you know, it says in block capital letters in the judgment, this does not infringe the GDPR. I'm just worried about the kind of advice that people have had over the past, you know, from people who don't really understand it.
Yeah. So did they take notes then of the case and just didn't felt like they couldn't keep hold of them? Is that what it was?
Yeah exactly that, yeah. And I mean, there were criticisms of the note taking, so saying there's nothing was in inverted commas, so there's no idea to what was kind of recorded verbatim, what was, you know, expressed in opinion or a summarization of what somebody had said. So the actual what notes there were weren't in a good state, but the fact that they stated that they had made notes but then destroyed them so they didn't contributing to GDPR was like, oh God, blimey, you know, why? How have you got to that point? Why does it not seem logical that you should be able to keep this stuff? Why aren't you challenging it?
Yeah, I think in terms of retention and erasure, there's a lot of misunderstandings around it. I mean, there's one side of it, you know, where people keep everything or organizations keep everything just in case. Until they hit, you know, until they receive a SAR and realize how much of a headache it can be, and then on the other side, there's those that think, oh, okay, I've finished using this piece of information, I have to delete it right away, which obviously brings its own kind of risks. And I think it's that side of things that, that side of the coin that probably causes more risks, to be honest.
I actually saw a very similar news piece on LinkedIn, Phil. I'm trying to find it now, but my computer's been really, really slow. But it was something along the lines of a car hiring organization who, you know, provides vehicles for people to hire. And I think someone must have been prosecuted for a speeding offence, and but the police couldn't identify who it was behind the wheel. And they requested for the information from the company, and they said, oh no, we can't do that because the GDPR restricts us from disclosing that information to you. And I think in the end they were ordered to pay a £1,600 fine or something along the lines of that. But it's a very similar thing. I just think people still aren't quite aware as to what the GDPR actually permits you to do. People think it restricts you, doesn't it? But in actual fact, it's quite
It does in some cases, but it provides, it's designed as a, you know, framework to enable the free movement of data. That's what it says in its aims. How well it achieves that is debatable, isn't it? I don't know, again, if you've seen in the news that there's a class action, this is last week, a class action lawsuit filed against Grindr in the High Court in London. This is about, you know, remember the accusation that they've been selling the databases, their databases, and that certain individuals on the databases were approached by companies to try and sell them HIV therapies and HIV-related, you know, drugs and things. So that was quite interesting. It'd be really interesting to see how that one works out, because I think Grindr are saying, look, it wasn't us. You know, we haven't sold anything. So one person says, you know, I wonder if my phone's been listening to me. And, you know, maybe they're assuming it, the Grindr in the wrong. And maybe, you know, maybe they are, maybe they're not. But it'd be interesting to see how that one works its way through.
Yeah, definitely. Have you seen about Apple as well introducing an AI into its products?
Yeah. I did read something about that, yeah. Just remind me what it's about.
So, the new AI features are expected to assist in message writing, photo editing, and text summarization. And it looks like they are collaborating with ChatGPT in this. Yeah. So
I did read that.
Yeah, apparently, you know, that's going to still focus on privacy, which I'm not sure how exactly that will be the case in partnering with ChatGPT. Apparently, OpenAI won't have access to any information that I suppose is used on people's phones, but or stored on people's phones. But yeah, they're calling it above artificial intelligence, personal intelligence. So, you know, they're not as up to date as the likes of Google and OpenAI in terms of AI or the AI arms race. But it looks like they're trying to get the footing in there anyway.
Yeah. I said to Joe yesterday, I want to do a big session on biometrics at some point soon. I noticed the European Data Protection Board issued an opinion, I think last week or week before, on facial recognition at airports. Again, that was quite interesting to read, because they haven't looked at the applicability of Article 9, which was a bit of a surprise, or 6 or 7, they say. They're looking at Article 5.1e, which is public task, and 5.1f, which is legitimate interests. They're looking at privacy by design and looking at security. And they really, it's quite interesting to read, because they've looked at four different scenarios or methods of working, one of which is where the passenger owns the facial recognition authentication token, and they carry it around. Basically, they stand at a booth and the booth scans them. They stick their token in, and if there's a match, then they're through. And they're only considering putting it in three or four places in the airport, you know, at certain key points, like accessing the lounge facilities, security gates, baggage and that type of stuff. But then they're going through these four scenarios, and one of which is that the airline holds a database of facial recognition data, biometric data, and then when you get where you know to one of these control points, it scans you and compares you back to the database. And in those circumstances, it's saying that they don't think that Article 5, 25 or 32 are met, you know, if it's a centralized database. But if the identity token is owned by the passenger, they're saying it probably is met. So they haven't tested Article 9. But that was quite interesting to read. That's about 46 pages. But the way that I like the way they go through everything and construct their arguments. It's quite an interesting read. But there's been a lot of stuff about biometrics. And, you know, what with the Serco and then attending InfoSec and seeing all these new tools popping up. Yeah, I just think we ought to have a big session on it at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
Agreed.
Yeah. I've actually got a little story to tell you guys. I feel like data protection real life scenarios only ever happens to me.
Sorry, just to answer Lucinda, they're saying no, that this is, so they're saying that the lawful basis is going to be probably consent, and this is just one way of getting through these points in an airport. And if you don't consent, you won't go through it, you go down an alternative route. So they're not attempting at this point in time, thank you, to force passengers to use this technology. Sorry, Joe, interrupted there.
No, it's all right. Yeah, so a couple of weeks back, I actually moved into my first flat. I moved in to a new build property with a friend.
Carry on.
I was just going to say, so moved into a property, went to set bills up and Wi-Fi, but apparently my address does not exist. So that has led to quite some complications around kind of like, you know, data accuracy, obviously, because the address is a real address. The whole property exists, but my one specific address does not exist, and it's just kind of led to some complications.
Is it a new build?
Yeah, but everyone else's flat's there, just not mine. Mine's 3A. I think it's the only one in the building that's like three.
Oh, that's strange.
A number and then A on the end. We have an electricity meter in the property, but it's not linked to my flat. It's linked to, I think they said flat 56.
The lamppost outside.
Well, it said flat 56, and I reached out to the estate agent, and they said there's no flat 56 in that building, so that must be the lot of the building. So currently, my property is, the electricity meter in there is linked to the area of the land as opposed to my specific flat.
Keep it that way? Yeah. Felix is
there. Because when he goes to buy a new telly in Curry's and they say, give us your address, he says it's 3A, whatever, they say that address doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, he might find that it might affect your credit rating, all sorts of things, Joe, if you've got a non-existent address.
Yeah, it could cause some real sort of issues. And if I wasn't, you know, literate on computers, and, you know, if I was perhaps an older person or someone who wasn't particularly tech savvy, you know, it could cause even, you know, more severe issues, couldn't it, for some people? So just kind of wanted to raise it as a point that how important it is, you know, that data is accurate at all times, because it could cause some real complications for people.
Who would you say is at fault here?
I'd say Joe.
Well, I've got to do all the work to rectify it, but I'd probably say the estate agency, I guess.
It just takes a while. Well, I don't know. It takes a while to register roads on all the various databases. Where we moved 25 years ago into this house, it was a new build, and it didn't come on the databases for ages. But if you're, it's just your flat, the property's there, flat, but your flat's missing. Yeah.
Sorry, I've just frozen. I don't know if you asked anything there. You both froze. But yeah, it is a real issue. I don't know who's at fault, Jasmine, to be honest with you. Estate agent, probably, perhaps. I don't know. The person who bought it. But apparently, we reached out to the estate agency anyway earlier this week, and they said that they've contacted Royal Mail, apparently. And if it's on Royal Mail's database, then utilities will be able to find it. And that made me think, why on earth would it be Royal Mail's database? But I don't know. Perhaps loads of organisations go.
Yeah, I think that they hold. I would have thought Land Register would hold a database, but Royal Mail's got a kind of a database of all properties, haven't they? And you update if you move. You can go on the Gonaways, and you know.
Well, the address did exist on the government website, gov.uk, but we've had complications trying to deliver stuff, you know, like if we've ordered a takeaway or whatever, the actual whole area of our postcode doesn't even exist either. So it's just a little bit of a nightmare, a little bit some teething issues. But yeah, I just wanted to raise it.
It reminds me of a lecture I once went to, a geography lecture I was forced to go to with my daughter when she was studying geography at school, about countries that don't exist. So there are lots of countries in the world, quite a substantial number, like 14 or so countries that don't exist. They're not recognised. What do you mean by existing? You know, they're not recognised by the United Nations. You know, they're not recognised by other countries or whatever, and therefore don't, in theory, exist. And I can't remember off the top of my head where they are. But this guy wrote this book about it. It's quite interesting if you like that kind of. Anyway, moving on. Go on then, Joe.
No, that was it. I was enjoying that, Phil. That was the end of mine.
Countries that don't exist.
What classes as a country then? Is that
self-declared countries? You know.
So does that have people living on it?
Definition, yeah. I think there's actually an oil platform off the UK somewhere, which this guy has declared himself a sovereign state. He's got a flag. He's got a capital city. He's got a resident population. But most other countries don't recognise it as existing. Therefore, it's the physical location, which is apparently a country, but doesn't exist. I'll find the link to the book. It's quite interesting if you like that kind of thing.
But yeah, that is the hour. So we should probably wrap it up there, Phil, if you can find the link.
Absolute nonsense, haven't we, for an hour?
Next week, we'll be back with a session on the charity sector with Rebecca Wells, a guest speaker. Through our, you know, pre-session call, we already had so much to talk about, so it's going to be really interesting. Even if you're not in the charity sector, if, you know, direct marketing relates to you or you just handle sensitive information, there will be something of relevance there, so please come along anyway. But yeah, in the meantime, thank you for joining us and have a great week.
Just like to put it out there, I agree with you, Jasmine, in terms of that. I think we're going to be focusing, aren't we, on kind of like vulnerable data and special category data and kind of the relationship between a DPO, a vulnerable individual, and also ensuring that, you know, that they get the support they need, but are also, you know, their rights are protected at all times. So although it is charity focused, it definitely applies wider than that. So yeah, do come along, and it's set to be a good session.
Now, are you doing a Tough Mudder? I heard a rumour you're doing a Tough Mudder this weekend, Joe. Is that true or not? Miles is, isn't he?
Not anymore.
I don't think he did it. I think we kicked the idea around, but I think the date came up on us a lot quicker than we realised, and we thought, I think it was about a week ago, someone realised, like, are we doing that thing that we mentioned we were going to do?
On Saturday,
like,
oh,
like, yeah. Yeah, oh my God,
it's next
week.
I'm going to watch you and cheer you on. But
no, we're not doing it, unfortunately. We'll have to do another one later in the year.
Fine. On that note, have a great weekend.
Cheers, guys. See you later.
See you later.
See ya. Bye.
Lucinda?
Sorry, Ronnie's hand. I was meant to clap and not. Thank you all.
Thank you for clapping.